हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सदि गौरवभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
So last time then we established about the mode of goodness, the position of the mode of goodness, the importance of the mind being situated in goodness. That this can't be underestimated. This whole idea that we're modern people in a modern age and modern everything and all this, and that takes priority over God's laws, that's basically just false ego. It's conditioning, it's attachment, it sounds good, a lot of people in the room will agree with it, you gotta be practical, you can't be fanatic, but everything that has been said in those syllables has been false ego. Right? Now, it's not that there's not some important points there, that one can't be fanatic, meaning that you're just following a rule because you're supposed to, but better you're following a rule that you're supposed to, that God gave, than following a rule that you're supposed to, that man gave. Because in the same way, they'll be very, very strict about, you know, stopping at the light or not driving on the curb or driving on the correct side of the street. And if you don't, they'll say you're crazy. You can't do anything else other than follow the state laws. But somehow or another, following God's laws, whether you understand them or not, then that's fanatic, dogmatic, this, that. Where is that coming from? Atheism. Right? We have to remember is that we're in this material world not because we're pure devotees. We're here because we've taken up an atheistic mentality. What's that atheistic mentality? We're God. Right? So, therefore, we cannot overestimate the stress on trying to follow an appropriate lifestyle. And at least, if not, the mentality. Because the point is the mind. As we discussed, it doesn't matter what situation you're in. It's what you do with it that counts. Does that make sense? Karma is created by what you do with the situation, not by what situation you're in. Right? You're in a situation that's good or bad, it's my karma, we'll say. But you have to remember, that's the results of your activities. Right? It's the result. It's not what you're doing now. And the environment you're in may have a bearing, but in one sense it doesn't have it all. You know what I'm saying? You go into a kitchen, everything's there ready to cook. Now there's a good chance you'll cook. But you could also decide just to curl up in the corner and take a nap. Does that make sense? So the whole idea is that, therefore, is that you try to create as positive an environment as possible. The environments that people are in nowadays is from the previous activities. You change your present activities, you change the future situations you're in. So the present situation that everybody's in, this modern, this, that, blah, is because they've acted in a modern, blah way. So if you want to continue in that modern blah way, then you keep dealing with the present in a modern way. You want it to change, you change it. Right? We see throughout history, depending upon the mentality of the people, then the age changed. Right? Parasuram, he went around and killed all the Kshatriyas. Now they're in the Treta Yuga. And in this time, they're behaving badly. They don't accept authority. They think whatever they think is the way it goes. It's vox populi. Sound familiar? Right? So then Parasuram took his little axe and went around and chopped off all their heads. Right? He did that for 21 generations. That means 210 years. Right? So, after having done that, there's no Kshatriyas. So it's Treta Yuga, so then Niyoga can be applied. So all the Kshatriya women, they approach elevated Brahmins for children. Then those children that were born, then they were very, very elevated. And so all they did was everything in connection with God consciousness. It's still the same Treta Yuga. In fact, it's 210 years later. More degraded. But it turned into golden age. It was Satya Yuga. Does that make sense? So in other words, we say all this stuff. Yes, you're the, you know, you can, you know, what is it? You work out your own destiny, you know, you write the script, you do all these things. We'll say all that as long as it's modern, but we say it's Vedic, then it's, oh, you can't. No, we can't do it. It's Kali Yuga. We can't do any of this stuff. Do we see it's just a cop-out? We're just cheating ourselves, we're cheating others. It's not anything else. And who's doing this? The mind. Not somebody else. The mind. And we're buying into it. So, therefore, is that being situated properly, then that helps a lot. But most importantly is the mentality. So motive goodness means is progressive. You accept authority. Progressive means you accept authority. That's progressive. And what you're going to do with that understanding gotten from authority, you're going to use it to move your life forward. That's progressive. Not being liberal where you have no standards. That's not progressive. Right? It's just, you know, terminology people throw around that changes every, you know, 10 years. Right? So, so you're establishing yourself by mentality following authority. Okay? Now this brings us to another question. Why would we do this? Right? The mind is going to work on accepting and rejecting. That's what it does. It doesn't do anything else. So now this, the basis of this accepting and rejecting is why would we accept something and reject something else? There's going to be something we call good and something we call bad. Right? So what's good, we accept. What's bad, we reject. Right? Does this make sense? Right. So now the question comes down, means this is coming stemming from this mode of goodness, is how do we choose what's good and what's bad? This is very, very essential. So then if we say we're modern, we have to do this, that means then we're accepting the good and bad based on modern popular ideas. Not on what's authority, not on necessarily what's progressive, what's Krishna conscious. No, it's by what everybody else in the society dictates. Right? That's just general. And then specific, even within that, what we take. Because if you look at it, how much of the planet is America and England and, you know, a bit of Australia, well, it's pretty small anyway as far as people, and a smattering of people in Europe. Put it all together, how many million you get? 300 million? Out of 6 billion? So what does that mean? That means most of the planet is actually closer to following the principles that we talk about in the Vedic culture. Right? Whole of Asia. Right? Middle East, Africa, parts of the East Bloc in Europe, parts of the Mediterranean, South America, Central America, like that. Even the Canadians are a little bit more normal. Like that. So, what does that mean? So, that means modern is based by this. Then, even we go into America, how many are these liberal and this and that? Where do they live? They live in the cities. They are kind of around New York or around Los Angeles, maybe, you know, Chicago. The South is pretty conservative. The Northeast is very conservative. You know, the Midwest is conservative. Like that. You know, so what are we leaving with in there? right? You go to England. How much is, you know, these liberals like, no. So what it is there's a few people who are smart enough that they can write things, right? And say it very nicely, and somehow or another get it published. They're the ones that are setting this so-called modern concept. It's a very small percentage of the population. Very proud percentage, very qualified percentage, but very small. So this whole thing can change like that. You know what I'm saying? It's like this. What happened? No, it's so difficult. It's in 9/11. People were liberal, this, you know, anti-American, so many things like this and that. Bang, the next day after 9/11, everybody had American flags hanging everywhere. People put up flagpoles in their front yards. Every third house had a flagpole, not just hanging a flag from their front porch. You know, the last time you saw stuff like this is World War II. Going down this drive, you know, in New York, cars from the back, you know, they're hanging in their window. Even someone put off the back of their cars little flags hanging and going. That was one day. Right? And it stayed like that for years until Iraq, and then everybody took the flags down again. But it's just like that. You're dealing with the mind. You're dealing with modes of nature. It accepts, it rejects. It's once, you know, moment. Right? So now this good and it means what's good and bad is going to be based on your perception. How do you decide? The mind is like, we'll go back to our pillar here, okay? Now our pillar here, what do we look at? What do we see? Right? Because we're going to have, the mind is going to have to do some accepting and rejecting on this pillar here. We look at it. So what's it going to be based on? How am I going to look at it? I could look at it, well, you know, how, you know, is it the appropriate construction for this building? So I can look at it from an engineering point of view. Okay, those are 15 by 15 columns, but these are 15 by 20 columns. You know, why? Because it's in the center of the building, so it carries more weight here. You know, we could look at it that. So that's appropriate. Well, or at the same time, I think it's overbuilt, so it could have been 15 by 15. Or it's like, why those outside ones are 15 by, why they're not, when they're not 15 by 20? Right? Or we could look at it, okay, finishing, how well is it done? Okay, they put the bricks, or are they straight in line? You know, is the pointing? What do they? Is that what they call it? They call it West Pointing? What do you call it? In between the bricks, the mortar?
Oh, the grout.
Yeah, the grout. The finishing, is that straight? Is it even? And everything like that. How well done is the workmanship of the construction? Right? Engineer couldn't care less. Right? And the guy who's building it, he cares about that. And he just looks at the blueprint and whatever it says, he builds. So completely different perspective on the same thing of right and wrong. Right? Then you can look at the aesthetics of it and all things like that. You know, the nice cow dung smeared all over it because when they did the ceiling, they forgot to wash it off. So it's plastered all over the place. So we could say that's nice. Hey, it gives it a very natural kind of rustic look. Or we could say that's disgusting. You know, why? How come they, you know, didn't clean it properly? Is this starting to make some sense here? Why we're going down this road? It's very arbitrary which one you're going to pick. So depending upon you, why would you do? If I am an engineer, I'm going to look at it from that perspective. Right? If I do construction, I'll look at it from that. If I'm an interior decorator, I'm going to look at it that. Right? And if I'm a dog, I'm not going to look at it at all. I'm going to be looking for something else. You know, the column is just something I have to walk around. You know, so you're right and wrong. I walk this direction, my head hurts. I walk 2 feet over, my head doesn't hurt. Does that make sense? So it's all going to be according to your conditioning. So this idea, modern, this, that, you got, that means they're looking through modern eyes. Why? Because they themselves have personally accepted and committed to it. Does that make sense? So this principle of right and wrong, how you view things, now this is where we really get down to the question. What do you choose as right and wrong? What do you choose as your perspective? That's what makes you who you are. right? So all these self-help things, they're going to all talk about how to make an identity. The psychologists, they're going to try to create an identity for you, right? They create your identity, what's right and wrong. They won't tell you, they'll kind of lead you there in some very strange way. Because if they tell you, then bang, session's over in one time, and that's it. They lead you on. You can get at least 10, 20 out of it, and at $300, you know, dollars an hour, you know, you make a lot more money. Right? So, you know, so that perspective also has to be there. Does that make some sense? Right? So now, you're going to choose. So we see, what are the acharyas always doing? What are the scriptures always doing? They're giving an identity. They're giving a perspective by which you can view the world around you. That's practical. Right? They give you a sense of what's right and what's wrong according to that perspective and your identity and your goals. Does that make sense? So that's what Vedic psychology is for. It's for creating the Vedic perspective on things, who you are, what you're trying to do, what is your goals, and therefore, how to go about it. Right? If I want to go back to Godhead, I have one set of rules and what's good and bad. I want to go to hell, I have a different set. Does that make sense? So it's not, they're all going on at once. You have the same school, some kids are getting straight A's. Some kids are flunking out. They're in the same classroom. Same environment. So it's what you do with it. You could say, yes, but then the home environment is this and that. Yes, it may be true. You can be affected by that. It's natural you're going to be involved in it. But there are also kids that come from all kinds of not very nice backgrounds, and they become very, very prominent citizens. Right? Does that make sense? So, that whole idea is that what are you therefore going to choose? It's down to you. What are you going to choose as an identity? What are you going to choose as your perspective? And therefore, what is the, list or the grouping of what is right and wrong? You know, what's appropriate? Because they'll say, it means that modern liberal, oh, it's so many perspectives. Yes, we agree. There are so many perspectives. But still, there's a hierarchy of perspectives, depending upon what you want to do. So many are there, but what do you want to do? Oh, anybody can say anything, freedom of speech, but then we don't want the kids to become polluted and, you know, set up a bad environment. So then there's a specific perspective here. You want people to be able to speak their mind, at the same time not ruin other people's lives. So where do you find that? So it's not that scientific, it's not defined. So the Vedic idea is everybody can have their perspective, but everybody has to respect everybody else's right in their perspective. So that means then you have to base your perspective on something that is broad enough to accommodate all that. Right? Liberals can't accommodate it. Conservatives can't accommodate it. Who can? God. He created it. So he knows all the different aspects that will make it work. Right? Does this make sense? I mean, it's what we're going through here. So in other words, it's not arbitrary what's right or wrong. There is a set standard right and wrong that was there before, is there now, will be there again tomorrow. It doesn't change. God's laws don't change. And if we notice, it's so done so nicely, the variety is so unlimited, both in shape and form and situations and everything that you may consider. So that means then the application of God's laws are just as unlimited. So that means there's no such a thing as the Vedic system doesn't apply now because this is a different time. It always applies. Do you think that trees actually care whether you're a liberal or conservative, whether you're this religion or that, or from this country or that country? Does the tree care? Does the dirt care? Does the air care? Does the water, does the sense of taste, touch, smell care? Does gravity care? What cares? What if God's laws care what your mentality is? They go on despite. Does that make sense? So this idea we can see that I'm special and different and separate and we got to adjust everything around me, what does that mean? That's self-centered, not self-realization. Right? So the whole idea of Krishna consciousness means that we review this. We look at this with a very cool head. Right? How to understand our position, who we are. And therefore, from that, what perspective? Because there's unlimited perspectives you can look at it. They say, well, it's not modern. What is even modern? If we sat down and got a whole bunch of people and said, what's modern? There would probably be a wide variance of opinion. Very few people would agree what's good or bad. If it was so easy, then why would they even have to elect a president? Everybody just automatically want the same guy. Right? Why are there fighting? Why are there wars? Why are there anything? Because everybody has a different idea. So the only way to bring all that together is following God's laws. You don't have another way. So now these laws, because the application of the laws is unlimited, that means there is an application for every time, place, and circumstance of the laws. Does that make sense? So now that means you have to be aware, you have to be conscious, you have to be educated to be able to apply that. Now this is where the false ego really gets agitated. Because one doesn't know, therefore one can't be anything less, therefore one has to try to establish your own position by attitude. Right? That's the problem. Because I can't handle that, okay, I'm 50, 60 years old, and I still don't know all these things. Right? So I can't handle that. So we don't be fanatic. What does don't be fanatic mean? Do what they do, because you'll hear them. If you're not fanatic, how is it they can sit all day and criticize everything that everybody else does? So if you're not fanatic, you'd be cool. Yeah, hey, he's doing that. Oh, that's great. Oh, he's doing that. Oh, that's fine. No, he has something to say about everything. Right? So what does that mean? That means very narrow-minded. It just means if your narrow-mindedness is in line with my narrow-mindedness, then we're cool. And if not, then you're an idiot. You know? Whoever's ego is bigger, you know, wins. You know what I'm saying? So this is the problem. It's not real. So the idea is this: anybody, anywhere, can bring their perspective in line with this Vedic, because it is the universal principle. And it's universally applicable to everybody, because God's laws function on everybody. The modes of nature get everybody. Birth, death, old age, disease catch everybody. So then why everybody couldn't use this mentality? Right? So these perspectives, these are given. It's all these that's why these perspectives are there. Right? Why do we have these perspectives of the 24 elements? Right? Earth, water, fire. Why do we have that? Why you know, sambandha abhideya prayojana? Why do we have these? So that we can start looking at everything according to this, because you're going to have some perspective. So the soul being servant of God, these are the most important perspectives, because these are what create self-realization. Then, according to your position on the conditioned platform, or just say even, we say you're not conditioned, within the material sphere, just the material functioning, then according to Varna and Ashram, you'll take those perspectives to perform your duties. Right? You're a grihastha, you look at things this way. You're not a grihastha, you look at things in a different way. But the common point is that spiritual thing, that's overarching of everything. But otherwise, even the Vedic, it's worked in that all of them work together. So that means it's God's, if you have a body, they all work together, right? The arms work with the legs and work with the head. It's not a problem, right? The knee's not trying to eat all the food, and so the mouth has to go and complain. Everything does what it does. So that means if the Varnas and Ashrams are fighting, that means they're not understanding what's Vedic. Because Varnashram is the body of the Lord. So the Lord's body doesn't fight with each other. The different parts don't fight. So therefore, that means it wasn't Varnashram. It's not Varnashram. The Brahmacharya's grasses don't get along. It means that's not Varnashram. They're not following God's laws. Right? Does that make sense? In other words, the perspective isn't right. The central self-realization is not right. It's based on the conditioning. Right? You're Brahmacharya, you're okay. Grihastha, you're not okay. You're Grihastha, you're okay. You're Brahmacharya, you're faking it. You understand? So the perspectives aren't right. Therefore, then there's anxiety, there's fighting, there's all these different things that come up. So the idea is what the acharyas say, their mentality, that's what we accept, that's what we make work. Then we try to reuse our intelligence and as best as possible apply that to whatever we're doing right now. Does this make some sense? Okay, so we've seen that showing how see, it means you have to choose right and wrong. Otherwise, you have to have an identity. You have to have some method to perceive everything. Otherwise, you can't function. You're only going to be active if you have goals. Therefore, you have processes to get those goals. But how do you determine those? Make them up, get them from friends, or base it on Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Right? Then, then you're going to apply that as, therefore, what's according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, that's according to my position right now, that's good. What's according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, that's not according to my position right now, that's not good. So I have to figure out what rule applies, what concept, what perspective applies. Does that make sense? That's the whole thing. Why are kids kids? They can't tell the difference. They're at home, they yell and scream. You take them out to a formal situation, they yell and scream. Therefore, they're called kids. Right? An adult knows at home they can kick back and they go out, you know, they're wearing black tie, then they're very formal and everything and very nice. So that's the whole point, is you have to be able to know what perspective to use in what situation. That's why the Veda gives so many, that's why it seems as confusing. It's not confusing at all. It's just different perspectives to use at different times. But all those perspectives have the same purpose. Right? God realization, pleasing Krishna. They don't have something else. Does this make sense? Does this all kind of pull together? Right? You know, so this is what you're trying to do with the mind. If you're not doing this, the mind will give you trouble. Because if you let it stray off into passion, ignorance, it will be unsatisfied. Because it's natural in goodness. That fish is in water. It's happy. You take it out of the water, it's not happy. So you take the mind out of the mode of goodness, it can't be happy. And the mode of goodness is what you create, not what you're in. You know? It's all got... Why do we take people in history as special? They were in a situation. You know, France is in chaos. Right? Napoleon comes along. All the other nobility, all the other, you know, aristocrats, all everybody else is in the same situation. They're overwhelmed by it. He comes along, takes control of it. Does that make sense? Right? It's the same Palestine. The same people are there. The Romans are there. Everything's there. It's the same political mess. The same oppression and everything. But one person stands out because he's unaffected by it. Does this make sense? So if you just want to be another face in the crowd, then say that. Don't come up with all this modern, this, that. Just say, no, I would rather take the blue pill. That's all, you know. Just, I just want to fit in. I don't want any trouble at all. I just want it to work so that my eating, sleeping, mating, defending goes along smoothly. And then on the side, I'm a little religious, and how much I think Krishna consciousness needs to be there, that much I'm going to follow. But it's me that's going to say that. Just say like that. That should be, you know, the full explanation when you say, no, it's modern. That's all. Just expand it. Don't leave it in such mystical terms. Just bring it, you know, right on. We're honest these days, straightforward and all that. Just say, I'm attached, and this is the way I am. You know? Like that. Okay. You had questions? Sorry.
Thank you, Maria. Actually, the question that you can elaborate this regarding display from the condition in the state of mind, of the mind in the power of discrimination, which depends on the intelligence, and actually how this is brought about by my rasa, my tendency to taste, which is the mind. But actually, just before that, I wanted to, if you allow, to grab what I have heard in the position, and actually also ask if there is nothing, you know, particularly understood, please interrupt me, right? So you started explaining how actually Krishna and his energy only exist. So in this, if I take it as a conglomerate mass of energies, I still use my impersonal identity. I don't understand the variegatedness or the parinamabala, which Vanyotas will say that if one doesn't understand this, he continues to be a mayavad. So in this broad spectrum of variety, let's say like in a rainbow, we cannot discriminate exactly where the one color ends and the other ends. But I can see, looking at the scripture, that Krishna has, since he is actually the source of everything, he also has to be the source in the original shrink, right? Mm-hmm. Therefore, I have to relate to him in order
Third canto and 11th canto, those are Krishna's shrink sessions.
Good. Actually, Prabhupada in one commentary says that since Krishna has psychology, expression and all that, he says that's why we have it. That's very interesting. So, and we can see also how Krishna, according to, because you say that the mind predominates the spiritual world, so according to his mood, his taste, he relates accordingly to the other ones that they relate to him. Mm-hmm. So we have the conglomerate mass of energy, but actually there is a separate energy also of the Lord, that is the jiva and the separate, let's say, in the sense of the material world. Still, he is the controller, but this part is given to others to manage. Mm-hmm. I am here right now. I try to understand to reconnect again. But when I see Krishna acting in Vrindavan, in Dwarka, in Mathura, in Ayodhya, so I had to really see this changing of energy, which is not changing because it's the same person, but not manifesting.
Means it's, I'm here, means, I would just say like that, and then you continue, is that, take it to, means this element of chinta beta beta tattva, where it's simultaneously one and different, that you have these energies and they're all functioning in the same way, but the difficulty is that how the material energy functions and how people relate and deal in that is exactly the same way they do in the spiritual world. There's no difference in that way as far as mentality, psychology and all that, the fundamentals, how it's functioning. The difference is that in the spiritual world it's all about Krishna. He's the center. In the material world we try to make that center ourselves. So that's why there's so much difficulty and argument and all that. If you go back in the Kali Yuga, everybody makes themselves. You go back into the Dwapara, then there's more of a tendency towards the Shastra and all that. So it's 50% more about God. You know, in Kali Yuga it's only 25. In Treta 75, sati 100%. So there's no problems at all there. So as it goes, it's just getting more and more self-centered rather than God-centered.
So that's what I'm trying to take it now.
That was the point. So the point is that so what you're trying to do is switch from the material consciousness to the spiritual. Now, how the material and the spiritual work are the same, but if we simply emphasize so much the sameness, we won't make the distinction. And then like the Sahajiyas, then we'll make the mistake that I'm doing something mundane and I'll take it as spiritual. Or I'll take something they're doing in the spiritual world as mundane because I don't distinguish. So that's why then the Shankhya and the breaking down of everything and the making distinctions between things is therefore a very strong element of Krishna consciousness. But in that distinction, it also can't be taken to extreme that there's actually a separation. Like that one time some devotee was making some comments about Vishnu. You know, about Vishnu, about Krishna. And Prabhupada said, don't make so much distinction. It's the same person. It's just the mood is different. That's all. But they're making it as completely different. So the thing is the energies is there. It's the same. But there's a slight flavor difference in them. So when you make such a strong thing between the internal, the jiva, and the external, then you get the whole existential position of the jiva becomes too prominent in the equation. So it's that means it's got to be blended more, but that blending that takes thought. Because just like you're saying, you can't separate where the yellow stops and the red goes. But actually, if you can see yellow, you can see where yellow is in the whole spectrum. And it does have a beginning and an end. Though that beginning and end overlaps with, you know, the blue and the red. But you can see, you look at it, that brick over there, that's red, but there's got some blue in it, plus a little highlights of very little highlights of yellow. You know what I'm saying? So you can see the color. So that's why you learn Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana as separate entities. But when you apply it, the Sambandha goes through the whole thing. The Abhideya is connected to the whole thing. The Prayojana is connected to the whole thing. It's just, where's the prana? Like yellow is through the whole spectrum. But here it's yellow. You know, here it's red. Here it's, you know, like that. So you can say, here's red, here's yellow, here's blue. But at the same time as those blend, and then that's the whole thing. So that's the Vedic culture, is you learn the separate colors, but you learn to apply it. It means academically you learn the three colors, but when you application, you have to be able to tell, is it, you know, yellow or yellow with red or yellow with blue or yellow with red and blue in what proportion? Yes.
That's right, because since the question tends to lead towards rasa,
I was just correcting because I felt you were making too much distinction in the energies there.
Now, for instance, the energies are the mood of the world. Okay? Therefore, the city of Navadvip, the city of Vrindavan exists. We cannot deny that this is an area of activities of the Lord.
Okay.
I mean, Dwarka and so forth. I have to really enter into the personal aspect now.
Okay.
Regardless of what the jiva position is, whatever it is. So, in this perception, I also come now, even if I want to analyze, and I should, if I analyze the Achintya Veda, the Tattva, includes everything, the Buddhist people, the void area exists here, or the place where the Lord doesn't manifest any activity, that's Viraya. We should accommodate that according to Continental Growth, that's there for the Buddhist. We cannot analyze nothing. Mm-hmm. But the point is that Krishna consciousness, in particular, that's why, yes, you're right, it's very difficult to discern where starts something and begins the other. And I want to bring this now just to the devotional angle here, not just in the mood of goodness my mind had to analyze everything and contemplate, because the mind is meant to become in Yeshudasattva, be established in Yeshudasattva, how this element of entering into the transcendental, we have to be a reality, it's not something in mind. It's although depending on my imagination, right?
It just say one other thing just comes up is that on here, let's say like you have Vrindavan, you have Mathura, you have Dwarka. Right? So now when we'll put it, we'll have Dwarka, is perfect, Mathura is more perfect, Vrindavan is most perfect. Because Mathura technically is that blurry place between the two. Vrindavan is very clear, Dwarka is very clear. Mathura is not clear. But discussions about Dwarka, Mathura is not very clear in the Shastra. Because it's where the two meet. It has the elements of that enthusiastic attraction and elements of rasa of Vrindavan, but it's still within the, you know, Krishna and Balaram are walking into Mathura with four arms. And, you know, the ladies on the roofs are completely going nuts. You know, so you have these combinations between these two. So that's there, but at the same time as these combinations aren't necessarily where the clearest rasa is tasted. You know what I'm saying? So from the perspective, when you're dealing with the tattva and the positioning, it looks one way, but when you apply the rasa, sometimes it switches. Therefore, when we see we apply the elements, let's say, of surrender, then when we take the gopis, you have then the exact, because it's the only example where they talk about this generally, is the gopis, not the gopis, it means Kubja is taken as the Mahishas of the head of the Mahishis of Mathura, but that's the lowest stage, because she's interested in, means she sees her sense gratification fully in connection with Krishna. But it's still her sense gratification. The queens at Dwarka, they're married, so therefore it's 50% them, 50% Krishna. You know, they please Krishna, he pleases them. The gopis in Braja is 100% pleasing Krishna. Right? So we see here is that there's a clear, it's just like in rasa. Rasa is sensual, emotional, transcendental. But there's five stages of consciousness. Between sensual and emotional, there's the platform of economics. Right? Between emotional and and devotional, there's transcendental or liberation. So even though technically pranamoy is higher than anamoy, when it comes to rasa, the rasa is tasted at anamoy. Extended sense gratification means it's someone else's sense gratification, but you're still tasting sense gratification. That's why it drops down. That's why we make a distinction between that and the emotional, which is based on religion. In other words, it's okay. You see the mother interacting nicely with the child. Okay, means the mother's interacting with her child. That's on that's on the platform of the senses. Then she sees another mother interacting with the child, and she thinks, "Oh, isn't that cute? Isn't that nice?" So that's extended sense gratification, but it brings her back to the platform of her interaction with her child. So the taste is still anamoy, though the platform that you access it through is pranamoy. Right? But manamoy, or religion, means is, isn't that nice? She is a good mother. See how she cares for her child. Right? That gives even a deeper feeling of rasa than simply the mother's interacting. But it contains the other. So the religion contains the sensual. But the sensual doesn't contain the religious. So that's why when people talk morality and economics and justice, their platform of rasa is the senses. And then if they throw out the senses because of their morality, they're puritanical, what do they have left? Nothing. They just dry up. And because they're dry and frustrated, they make it a point in their life to make sure everybody else is miserable. By taking the rules of their pranamoy, of morality, and banging it over everyone's head. And if you say, you know, manamoy, then they'll say, oh, don't be fanatic. But they're the most fanatic. Does that make sense? So there's always going to be that switch. In when you're, means tattva, it's just like in tattva, you'll go sambandha abhideya prayojana. But when you're dealing with emotion and rasa, it goes sambandha prayojana abhideya. Right? So that's how it functions. The mind, as we're saying, it perceives a field. So that's what we were talking about today, is are you going to deal with that field in the mode of goodness according to authority and choose your perspective based on self-realization? Then, having done that, you get attracted to be active in that field, because there are now goals that you can get from that. And then when I see that goal, I have the identity, then I will act. Yes, that's why Rupa Goswami is the most prominent. So Abhideya becomes the most prominent element. Sambandha is there. You have to have that. That's why Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, is considered the elder brother. Because without Sambandha Gyan, so nectar devotion is based on the essential principles defined in the Hari Bhakti Vilasa, Sanatana Goswami. But then it's looked at it from the perspective of Abhideya. Just 1 second to make sure everyone's here. Do you all understand what's going on here?
I have no clue, actually, but it's okay.
Okay. So, because we're taking it as that, you know, because we've been talking about this for weeks now, so if you just come today, it may not make as much sense. You know? So, we're taking, because in one sense we'll look at, well, it's psychology on one side, but it sounds more like Krishna consciousness on the other side, but that's the whole point, is that psychology has to be applied where? In your life, your devotees, so therefore it's going to look like Krishna consciousness. Right? If you're not devotees, then that's not the psychologist's point. He doesn't want to get you to Krishna consciousness. When you go into his office, make an appointment, sit down on his couch, you know, he doesn't say, okay, you know, just let it be clear here is that we're trying to get you, you know, back to normal, back to Krishna consciousness, so you can go back to Godhead. He doesn't open like that. It'll be, no, we just want to see you happy and situated nicely and remove all your fears and all those kind of things, so that you can function as just another face in the crowd in this ocean of birth, death, old age, and disease, completely trying to absorb yourself in sense gratification, you know, and get whatever you can and work progressively with others so that you get what you need, they get what you need, and it's all nice, one big happy family of sense gratification. That's their opening statement. Does that make sense? So, therefore, it's going to look like, because we're not, it won't smell like the other thing. That's the whole point, is when devotees deal with any body of knowledge, you have the choice what you want it to smell like. You want it to smell modern, you want it to smell karmi, all you have to do is go out and get a book, use their terminology, and that's what it smells like. You know? That's what it smells like. Saying, you know, everybody's equal, we don't making no difference in everything here, and all this and that, and everybody has a safe say. Where does that come from? Does that make sense? Is it on that point? Okay, if it's on that point, because otherwise we're still on his question. If it's on that point, then go ahead.
Sure.
Try.
I was just thinking of this narrow-mindedness. Doesn't it come in? Like, for example, as devotees, sometimes we have a tendency, I sometimes have a feeling that, because of my conditioning, that we are more narrow-minded, but accepting whatever we have to
do. Narrow-minded means, okay. Sex, money, facility for that, and prestige. Now, is the modern culture working outside of these four? So, is that narrow or is that narrow? So the devotees have the same four problems and they add into it, you know, Krishna consciousness. So it's a touch wider.
I'm sorry, Prabhupada, I have to defend modernity here.
You have to defend
modernity.
You want to defend modernity,
right.
Not maternity.
Not maternity, modernity.
So you're against women, so that's... You won't defend maternity.
Modern. What is modern?
No, but what about the maternity?
Yeah, the wideness, the width. The width of modernity.
The width. You're discussing bandwidth here.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very wide.
It's very wide.
Just choosing the right handbag, it's a whole universe.
Yes, but the point is what handbag you're going to pick. And you pick the right one, and your friends will say it's great. And you pick the wrong one, and they'll say you're a jerk.
Right, but
you know what I'm saying? So where's the broad-mindedness? Because you and your friends, you've picked from the universe your bag, but anybody who doesn't pick the bag within yours, you pick the Gucci, they pick the whatever it is, Louis Vuitton. But someone else picked, you know, the Safeway model, and then you'll say, oh, they're out of it. That's not broad-minded. Broad-minded is, that's their bag, they like it. This is my bag. When I left, it was 2 years ago, left England, we were into, I forget what the place was, Sainsbury's, right? We were in Sainsbury's, and there was a bag there. They were selling because they want to be, you know, they're trying to project their they're environmentally friendly. So they made this bag out of cloth that you could put your groceries in instead of using the paper bags. And they had it there. It was £5 a bag. And I remember walking by, and I asked the devotees, hey, you want one of these bags? And they said, no. You know, they were very fashion conscious. Who wants a bag like that, right? And so that was there. Then about 6 weeks later, when we left England, I was looking in this mag. I think it was, you know, like a Time or a Newsweek. And the latest, hottest bag was that bag, because they're not available anymore. And you could buy them on Amazon for something like, you know, £250. You know, it was the bag. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it moves around. It may be a universe it's working from, but that universe is created by God, not by modernity. God created that. Now, the problem with modernity is only this much is right. Anything outside of that's stupid. And the Vedic is the point is God consciousness is the ultimate where you want to get to, but depending on your consciousness, you have all these other levels that you can function at. And so therefore, a kid is functioning at their level, they just has just as much rights as an adult. But their rights are going to be applied as a kid. Not that he can now do whatever he wants. No, he's a kid. He has to learn what's right and wrong. Then when he gets a practice, then he will have his say. So the thing is it's very narrow. The intellectuals think everybody else are idiots. The common street person think the intellectuals are puffed up. You know what I'm saying? The guys that are good looking think anybody else, are some kind of animals out of, you know, Monsters Incorporated. You know what I'm saying? And the other people think these guys are just puffed up and all that. So where is this broad-mindedness you're talking about? No, there's a lot of variety that we accepted. But narrow-mindedness is standard. Otherwise, how do you create an identity for yourself? If I don't go, okay, I'm an intellectual that's good-looking, a little bit, you know, upbeat, yuppie-ish, but I'm really, you know, good at my money and stuff like that, then, you know, therefore I drive this kind of car. I wear this kind of clothes. I live in this part of town. I go to these parties with these people. But you change that, you change where your parties are, where you live, what car you drive, and everything like that. Because they have to have an identity. So what we're saying is, you create an identity that's more universal. If it's based on the soul and God realization, therefore you can relate to any other living entity no matter where they are. The externals aren't important. The externals are for their conditioned needs. How they make their money, how they live their life. But it's not actually what's the main prominent element of God consciousness in the life. Does that make sense?
I had some practical questions, actually. I mean, I'm not a Vedic psychologist.
No. Hey, wait. Don't point that way. Because, see, he has been around a long time. And he's very thoughtful. So his question takes 10 minutes because there's 10 minutes of material that he's trying to pull together. He thinks about all these things, and he's trying to find where they fit together. So this isn't a 10-minute question based on he doesn't know what his question is. He's going around the universe trying to find it and just expressing himself. And it's what do you call that kind of literature where you just free-flowing, free, you know, the
automatic
mind is just...
Writing.
Huh?
Automatic writing?
Automatic, yeah. So something like that. It's not that. You get those questions, and if it was one of those, I'd stop it immediately within the first 5 seconds. But... his is, he's bringing out this thing and this thing, all these seeming contradictory things, so he's trying to present all the aspects of the field. Then, at the end, he'll bring it together in a one-sentence question. And so what we were doing is he was dealing with one part of it, and then we were discussing that. Then he'll deal with another part, we're discussing it. But in that, then she had a question on one of the parts, and then you have another question. So you know, it's very practical when you're trying to actually use these things. Because then it's a matter of, okay, I'm going. So, okay, do I pick this or this? Which one do I pick? You know, this one is, you know, practical and all this, but this one's smaller. You know, like that. And then, you know, this one may be a different thing. This is this. I like the color of this. This is kind of plain. Or I like the, you know, the practical. It looks very, you know, square and professional, while this looks more like, you know, something teeny bopper. So it goes on. That which one do you choose? It depends upon who you are and what you need. You know what I'm saying? You see these big fashion models and stuff like that, top stuff. They got their fancy bag, and they have a little Winnie the Pooh doll hanging off of it. And it works. You could say, well, hey, that Winnie the Pooh doll is, you know, for an 8-year-old. You know, but it works. You know what I'm saying? Because you have to be able to see the mentality. You have to see where they're coming from. Only the Vedic can give you that. The modern can't enter into that at all. They'll talk liberality, but it just means all they're talking about is be tolerant. Be humble and be tolerant. They're not actually talking about acceptance of it. You just have to be tolerant that others do these things. You don't have to accept them. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise, why it's not, you know, this and that? Does that make sense? You can't categorize people, but if you're going to do a study, you have to. If I write a PhD, I got to categorize. But at the same time, if I use it in a conversation, oh, you can't categorize. You know, so it's very contradictory. But the Vedic, these contradictions can be brought together because you're dealing with the whole picture. You know, it would be like saying is that I have the little box of, you know, whatever it is, the magenta and cyan, and what's the other one? Magenta, cyan, and what's the yellow one? They got another color.
Yellow.
Huh? They didn't say yellow. Okay, so you have the yellow, the red, the blue. And then that's very clear. This is modern. But the rainbow, that's the Vedic, it just doesn't apply these days. That's an old-fashioned thing. How long have rainbows been around? How long has, you know, dividing all the colors up into these three been around, right? Very, very recent. But rainbows have been there forever. So they don't apply now. That would be the approach. But the Vedic is because you can deal with the rainbow, you can see these three colors and all their combinations. So the person who can only see the three, he's starting. So when someone takes up Krishna consciousness, may have something to do with what you're saying, takes up Krishna consciousness, they'll just learn to see those three colors. But with time, so therefore it looks narrow. But with time, they'll be able to see where they blend. And so when you're dealing, let's say, with brown, you know that, you know, you have black, you have yellow, and you have red in it. So you can deal with the aspects of that. So when the yellow part is prominent, you deal with that. When the red is prominent, you deal with that. When the black is prominent, you deal with that. Or any combination of it. That's Vedic psychology. Prabhupada would go anywhere with anyone and be fine. He's sitting down in the Bowery with the drunks. You know, we go, the drunk comes by, you know, and like this, and tries to talk. And says, oh, get out of here. You know, Prabhupada, oh, okay, you know, very gentle with them. They come, you know, because he dealt with them nicely. When they come, they stand up, they, you know, tip their hat to him. They don't tip their hat to other people unless they're asking for money. They tip their hat to him out of respect. They didn't ask him for money. In fact, you have that story, the one, you know, bum coming into the place with a roll of toilet paper. He somehow came across toilet paper. What's he going to do with it? So he wanted to do something for the Swami. So he just careens into the place, you know, around, puts it in the thing, comes, tips his hat, and all that, and leaves. And Prabhupada just, you know, what's this guy? He's disturbing. No, it's that he's doing some service. That's broad-minded. That's Vedic. So the reason devotees have difficulty is because they're still contaminated by the modern. So they apply the modern perspective in Krishna consciousness, therefore the narrow-mindedness of that modernity against others' modernity clashes. Because in modern, I mean, it's like Iraq is there. They're a modern country. So is Iran. They fight. You know what I'm saying? The French and the British don't like each other. They're both modern. You know, the EastEnders and, you know, someone from other places, they don't like each other. They're modern. Brothers and sisters, pretty modern. They don't like each other. So that's the difficulty. Modern has this problem to it. Because modern, the definition is not according to Shastra. That's the simple definition of modern. So everybody will fight because it's not based on Shastra. If you see according to Shastra, why would you fight? Because everything is there in the Shastra. Every perspective. It wouldn't be a fight. Fight is there because we're contaminated by the mob. Does that make sense?
Can I ask you my practical questions?
Sure, but in my mind, what I just said is extremely practical. I use this day to day. I talk to people all the time, and if I don't see with this mentality, I can't talk to people. Because I have one person coming who is, you know, I have grihasthas coming, I have brahmacharis coming. I have people that are totally fanatic about something. I have people that are completely, you know, out in left wing on how modern they are. You know, I have all kinds of things. So if I can't function with this, so to me, this is very practical. He's a psychologist. Is it practical or not? Yeah. So then, and since it's about psychology, then, okay. Okay. What's your practical question?
Well, I'll do a practical commentary. I don't think we can extricate ourselves from history and from modernity.
Nobody said you are, but it's just like somebody drops some garbage on your front porch. What do you do with it? That's modern. It's happening right now. There's garbage on your front porch. What do? You pick it up. Why do you pick it up? Because you have a concept of that the garbage belongs over there and the front porch shouldn't have garbage on it. But now, if I was being real modern, real liberal, then it's just it happens. Garbage happens, right? Isn't that what it says? So therefore, I would just leave it there. And not only that, I have my own, you know, compost, you know, factory, and I can go organic because the garbage is sitting on my front porch. Not only that, it's free and available. Anybody comes along can have some. So that's the whole problem with the modern. It's that history is nothing, but who wrote this history? I learned that, you know, the Spaniards got in their little boats and they went over to South America and they liberated the barbaric savages from their, you know, perspective in life. What did they do? They went over there, killed their king and stole their gold. That's the reality. That's what they did. You know, they came to India and tried to uplift the savages here by destroying their culture. For what? So they could take all the wealth from here to Europe. They weren't generating wealth here and putting it back into here. So what is this history you're talking about? Who wrote it? You know, it's a common thing. Who wins writes the history? You know? Yeah, okay, so it's just like this. The British go into America, right? They're controlling America, and they take their men over there. There's rules of warfare, right? The Americans from behind trees are shooting them. That's called guerrilla warfare. You know, they go in and dump a bunch of tea into the sea. You know, they go steal someone else's tea and dump it into the ocean. You know, it's all guerrilla terrorist tactics. But because the Americans won, they write the history, then they say they're liberated and this and that, a good cause. The British probably don't have much good to say about it. They'll just say they're being very low class and uncultured, if you read British history. So when you say history, which one? Which one of the unlimited perspectives are you talking about? So that's why, unless there's a God-conscious perspective, you can't really know what's right and what's wrong. How do you actually judge it? So, is it progressive for human life to become God conscious? Yes or no? What is lacking in it? The Americans, they're sitting there, you know, all the way across the ocean. And they're having to manage their lives, and they're being controlled by a power that has nothing to do with them and know anything about them. That's a valid complaint, because in the Vedic thing, the king has to know what's going on with the people and make the people satisfied. So they have a valid complaint. The method they went about, trying to accomplish that complaint, that you can't say was really valid. Because they'd use techniques and this and that that weren't proper. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, in the Vedic, you say they have a complaint. So either England, you know, takes care of this, or, since they're willing to run their own lives, give them more sovereignty, or give them sovereignty. Right? Does that make sense? So that's then the Vedic perspective. That works for everybody. But the modern only works for the group who wrote it, when you say history. It doesn't work for the other groups.
So my question was, if there is a Vedic psychologist or a Vedic psychiatrist, who is a Vedic psychiatrist, who is a Vedic psychologist? Because usually when I have a problem, you know, I lose 3 times in a row at football or something, I go to my sports psychologist. And if you're married, you go to your marital counselor and stuff like that. Who is the Vedic psychologist? Is there a Vedic psychiatry? And, you know,
here's one right there. There's one sitting right next to you there. You can get his email right there.
Do I have to pay $300 an hour?
That you work out with him. That's between the two of you. I'm not getting involved. How much do you pay to your marriage counselor?
Yeah. I go on the public system.
Okay. Then that's good.
Cheap.
Okay, cheap. So then maybe you can work out a cheap deal with him. That's why Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra is there. You have the scriptures. They're there. So the Acharya is there. You have the other devotees to help you understand those things. That's the basic. And then basically you have to see who means, because you have a particular mentality, right? So you have to find which devotees are able to speak in a way that it makes sense to you from your perspective. Does that make sense?
They will not be forcing if I do so. They just kind of...
No. It's like this. Those who you see are authorized that are properly discharging devotional service and are accepted as such. Then those who can speak the Krishna conscious philosophy and the psychology in a way that applies to you, that you can use it, those are the persons you then associate with and take their direction. You understand? Because someone else may have good points, but they can't apply it to you because the scope that what they can deal with is in a particular area. Does that make sense?
It does, but nobody has been able to help me with my lying and cheating. I'm lying and cheating regularly. And I haven't got good advice yet. Maybe the prophet here will help me.
Maybe he can help. See, lying and cheating, why lie or cheat? Why lie or cheat? It's dangerous. So why would you lie or cheat? What is there in lying and cheating that is important?
All kinds of things, Prabhu. I think what you call prestige and facility.
Okay, but facility, but that facility is still based on the same thing. There's an experience that you're looking for. And somebody finds it by getting on the little bicycle or going down the side of a mountain and going off a cliff and then pulling their parachute. You get it by lying and cheating. You understand? So it's an experience you're looking for. And then that creates some facility for you if you win, if you don't lose. And that facility creates an experience for you. So it's the experience you're looking for. It's just lying and cheating happens to be the method you're using. It didn't have to be that. Other people get the same experience using something else. Right? You eat a sandwich, someone else is eating a pancake. But the taste and the experience of eating is the same. Do you understand? Does that make sense? Yeah. So, therefore, Krishna says in the Gita, he is the cheater of the cheats. So that feeling, that cheating, that's actually Krishna.
I knew it.
Yeah, but the point is... yeah. So you're looking for Krishna. But the point is this is a very low-end approach to Krishna. Krishna has so many other qualities, is so much nicer than this. You know what I'm saying? But if you understand that what I'm looking for is that experience of Krishna, then once you connect that, it disconnects it from the normal state of conditioned consciousness. And then you start to be able to be aware of it. Because right now you're caught up in it. It controls you. But when you do this, you're able to see. Because you become kshetriya. You become observer of the field, not part of the field. Then you can see is actually that experience is Krishna. Therefore, when I take bigger risk, there's more Krishna. Less risk, there's less Krishna. So the actual point is Krishna. So then if it's Krishna, then why am I looking for him here? Why not look at something indirect, like chanting, worshipping the deity, these other things like this?
Just out of curiosity, is lying ignorance, passion, or can it even be goodness? It
depends upon why you're lying. If you're lying because you think you're Napoleon Bonaparte, that's ignorance. If you're lying because there's something you want and you lie to get it, that's passion. If it's actually for the protection of someone else than that, it may even be goodness. Right? You know, somebody comes knocking on your door, you open the door, there's 10 guys there with guns, and they say, is this guy in your house? You say, no. you understand?
Yeah, just on the side of things, I saw some sign in another gurukula, chess is not allowed.
Chess is not allowed.
Yeah, is chess the same thing? Can be in goodness, in passion, and in...
It's just like this. Chess means you have to use your brain. So some people don't... They like something a little quicker, so chess is not allowed. Right? See, because in some places, like let's say you go to Puri, Jagannath Puri, down there people play chess, they bet on it. So therefore, some Indian devotees think chess is a game for gambling. But like in Australia... It means there's two flies sitting on the ground. Two Australians would go, which one's going to fly off first? And they bet on that. Right? So therefore, if we apply that logic, then having flies in your house is gambling. So therefore, everybody's got to have screens. You know. So chess is actually a Vedic game. It's just that the game that you see nowadays has been... I forget what it was. I think the 18 or 1900s. They change the rules a bit to make it faster. Like basketball now, they put that next to the line. You can only hold the ball 3 seconds and you shoot from here. Because it's getting too slow and people get bored and they don't watch. So the same with chess. The Vedic is the pawn that can only move one. It can't move two. When it gets to the opposite side of the thing, when it gets to there, whatever square it lands on, you can only get that piece back. You can't get any piece back. You know? What we call, what the modern calls the queen, that's the prime minister. That's the general. You know, you have the elephants, that's the castle. Then you have the horses, that's the cavalry. Then you have the bishop, that's actually the guys on, what do you call it?
Chariots.
Chariots. And then the pawns are the foot soldiers. Right? So it's a very, what, now a typical game will take you like 40, 45 minutes to play, half hour, 45 minutes. If you're playing it with Vedic rules, it'll take about 2 hours. So people just found it too slow, so they changed the rules. But it's a Vedic game. Those who actually know the history of those is a Vedic game.
What about Prabhupada's innovations?
Innovations.
Not
as
everything in ISKCON looks like things outside of ISKCON.
Yeah, so
Prabhupada was not an innovator in your mind?
He's an innovator, but that's an application. That's not in principle. Principle, he's getting exactly what the tradition is trying to get. He just does it in the present day context. That doesn't mean he's changed it. He knows the principles. Just like you have, let's say you have a good cook, but he's expert, so you put him in a kitchen with all facility, he can cook nice, but if the facility's not nice, he can't cook good. But a master cook can go into the kitchen, no matter what the pot or what he's got, he can make something out of it. That's Prabhupada.
And my opinion, and also Terence McKenna, which I think you may be familiar with, Terence McKenna. His opinion is that we all love innovation.
We love innovation, yes. Yeah.
Especially young people. I mean, no offense, but...
Why? Old people also like it.
Once you're over some years, you don't care for innovation anymore.
But that's a very narrow-minded opinion, isn't it?
I think it's quite justified, in fact.
But still it's narrow-minded. And if you're truly a modern person, you couldn't say that.
Maybe I'm a traditionalist.
But why is a traditionalist? Okay, now that you quoted this other guy that supposedly is a celebrity that I've never heard of in my life, then you're falling back on a very traditional thing of name-dropping and stuff like that. You dropped a name I couldn't give a damn about. So therefore, your position didn't increase one iota. But you worked on tradition there to try to establish and push forward your opinion. So now in the same breath to say those who are traditionalists, like that, why do you unbutton that top button? That's what people do. Why not unbutton the few on the bottom and leave the top buttoned all the way up? Now that's innovative.
I'm a traditionalist, probably.
Okay, so the thing is then why do you say that? So you're over 30?
Yeah.
So then why are you even talking about this? Because you wouldn't understand innovation because you're over 30.
No,
you're out of touch. No, you're remembering something that's past, it's gone, it's over, it's finished. You know, it's like that. You want to buy a suit before you bought one that... You go back to the 30s, you bought one that was bigger than what you would want. Then you bought one that was the same. Now you buy one that's two sizes too small. You know, like that. Unless you're out on the street, then you buy a coat that's at least, you know, 10 sizes too big. You know, if it doesn't hit your knees like a zoot suit, it's not the right size. You know, so you're out of 6 months, you're out of this. So if you hit 36 months ago, you're still on the last days. But if it was more than 36 months ago, you're gone. You're finished. You're history.
So my question was, if you agree, in case you agree that we love innovation, all of us, how do you think we should manage it? I mean, because what we see in...
let's look at it like this. You're sitting in my place. I'm not sitting in yours. If I go to your place, there's a good chance it looks like what everybody else's place looks like. This place looks a little different.
Mine as well.
Do you have trees growing right in the middle of your house?
No.
So then. We're being innovative here.
No, my full question is that.
The full question. Say it in one sentence. Otherwise, you don't know what your question is.
So. Innovation is running wild throughout history. Innovation is
yes.
going in all kinds of directions.
So innovation is running wild here. We have one devotee who, you know it or not, there's a lot of devotees in the army in Iraq that's being run by military. But normal devotees don't know about it because one devotee, he was in the army, and he started preaching and set up all kinds of preaching cells and things like that. He's even, you know, got a medal from, you know, the general that was over there. And he's introduced as our local Hare Krishna. Now that's innovative. So innovation's going on. It's just a matter of, you understand it, you understand the principles it applies, then you can apply it. So that's the difference. Someone who doesn't know anything can't be innovative. Someone who's expert at something is not necessarily innovative, but what they do is very good. Someone who's master at something, he's innovative, because he can take the principles of anything and apply it in any situation to anybody. So that's the Vedic concept. Get to the level of mastery. Then you're innovative. Like Western music. People sit there and do some innovation, but they don't know much about music. Or those who really are studied in music just play exactly what Beethoven and Mozart played. But in the Indian, you learn by rote exactly how to play the notes and everything. But in any performance, they never play the same thing twice. It's pure innovation. Way beyond what anybody in the West ever does. But they learn that by the exact opposite. So that's why it appears Krishna consciousness doesn't lack innovation, because you have to learn the form of it. Once you learn the form of it, then it becomes totally spontaneous. Like that. So it may start off looking more rigid than whatever's in the modern, but once someone's situated, they're way beyond innovation than the modern. Modern can't get close to it. You know? Indian musicians can write Western music no problem. They do it all the time, but Western musicians can't write Indian music at all, no question.
And my final question, Prabhu, is monogamy an innovation?
Is monogamy an innovation?
Monogamy, yeah.
Meaning having one wife.
Yeah.
Is that an innovation? I think it's practical. It's like this. Now, if you really want to make your marriage work, then you have to, as a man, have to be really aware of the needs of a woman. What is a woman and her needs? And if, to that degree, you're aware of it and able to deal with it, you have a working marriage. To that degree, you can't. So, because women are so complex in their feelings and emotions and expressions, how is it you're going to practically deal with more than one of them?
With the help of Krishna? The Maha Mantra?
No, it doesn't work like that. Because the point is Krishna is fine. He can have so many, but you're limited. You know what I'm saying? I don't see any goal. I don't see any nothing. So you don't got the money to take more care of more than one. Taking care of one would be as much as you can take care of. Because the point is women represent opulence. They're comfortable in an environment of opulence. So unless you can provide completely for two. Two women means two houses, two cars, two facilities, complete for them. Whatever the one wife would have, you have to be able to regenerate that completely for another one. I have a godbrother somewhere in the Caribbean. His father has 25 wives. He's got over 120 siblings. But each one of those wives has their own house, own complete facility, everything. Like that. And he's able to make it work. But if you can't make one work, there's no question you're going to make two work.
But lying and cheating can get you the problem.
No, it can't. Because women, up to a point, no. But after that, they understand. They can understand if you're spending time with them or not. But you're lying and cheating to go off with the other woman.
To get the houses and the guards.
Maybe you can. But then when you're locked up in jail, then they got nothing.
They will be even happier, bro.
So then if they'll be happier by not being with you, why don't you try celibacy? That sounds like the best thing for you. Okay. So, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Amaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, Nitai Gaura Prahmananda. Okay.